Good morning, John. John McCormick, I apologize. We're running even later than I promised you that I would run.
Not a problem.
John, get used to it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, I'd like to introduce John McCormick, author of 9 Algorithms That Change the Future, The Ingenious Ideas That Drive Today's Computers. John, can you do me the favor, the honor of giving us a little introduction of yourself and of the book, and then let's talk about it.
Sure. Well, I guess I'm a computer scientist. I've worked in a few different roles. I've worked in industrial research labs for Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft, trying to invent new computer technologies. And these days, I teach and research computer science at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania.
Fantastic, fantastic. And in your background, I know I saw on your bio, you've been kind of around the bend. You got mathematics in your background, which is a perfect grounding for computer science, which you did at Oxford. And it sounds like you've got an Australian accent. Is that correct?
I'm actually from New Zealand originally. I grew up in New Zealand, but I went to school in England. And I studied math for my undergraduate degree, which, as you say, is one of many good ways of getting into computer science. And yeah, then at grad school, I ended up studying computer science. I actually studied in a subfield called computer vision, which is the area where you try and get a computer to use a camera to understand something about what it's seeing through the camera. And yeah, as I said, I later ended up working for computer companies and now working in a college.
Excellent, excellent. And you came around and you wrote this book, and I'm gonna start off and let listeners know I've read a lot of the book, and I think I mentioned this to you earlier too. It's fantastic. If anybody out there who's listening who's interested in what really kind of is the hinge points of how our computer applications and our experience on the web works, put simply, it really is a well done book and very readable book. Whether you're in computers or not, and you shouldn't let the word algorithms scare you off. And John, I know you're going to tell us what an algorithm is and why algorithms are so important to the world and to computers.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. But actually, since you mentioned the scariness of the word algorithm, I sort of had an interesting experience with that myself, because the first time I met with my editor for this book, we also met with the marketing director at Princeton University Press, and they told me under no circumstances may the word algorithm go in the title of the book, because it's just way too scary. And that was a couple of years ago. Since then, times have actually changed. If you search for the word algorithm on, say, the New York Times, you're going to find that it's coming up, dozens of times a month. So it's starting to enter the sort of lexicon of everyday use. Another place where you might have seen it, if you've seen the movie The Social Network, which is about the true life story of the founding of Facebook, it also comes up there in one very significant scene early on, where the guy who goes on to drop out of Harvard and founds Facebook is desperately asking his friend, please tell me the algorithm that you use to rank chess players. So this word is actually starting to enter the popular consciousness. You've probably heard news reports about algorithmic trading on Wall Street,
yes,
which is when computers automatically conduct trades without any human intervention.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, let me answer your original question, which is, what on earth is an algorithm? And the simplest way of describing it is just to say it's a precise list or description of steps that you need to take in order to solve a problem. So at its most basic level, this definition actually has nothing to do with computers. We all learnt algorithms at elementary school and at high school. One of the simplest examples I can give you is the algorithm for adding up two large numbers. Suppose I gave you two four-digit numbers and asked you to add them up. You know, you're allowed to use a pencil and paper. You would have a set method of doing that, right? You would start at the right-hand side, add those first two digits that you see there. If the result is more than 10, you'd write down one of the digits and carry a 1 to the next column and so on. There's a bunch of steps that you learned at school. And what you actually learned was an algorithm. It's a precise list of steps that must be taken in order to solve a problem.
And of course, my algorithm today would be number one, get a calculator, and then, or better yet, open Excel.
Right. Okay. Yes. So the algorithm that you learned at school has actually been implemented as a computer program on every computer that you've ever used, including the most basic scientific calculators.
Yep. Yep. Yep, and so an algorithm really is just, as you said, just a description. It's a recipe. It's something that we do anyways, but that can be easily replicated and consistently replicated. I think one way that I've heard it described is though to separate it is that we come up with things that we're very proud of in science and in physics and so on, and a lot of times what those things we come up with that we're proud of is it's a single formula or it's a what. It's a we discovered this thing. Algorithms are much more about the how, right?
And exactly. Yes. Yes. So, yes, often in physics, an important result is summarized in a formula. So Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, is one of the great results of physics. In biology, say, in genetics, an important result might be summarized by a sequence of genetic code, C-A-G-T, something like that. Mm. In computer science, most of the important ideas are actually described by an algorithm. And exactly as you just said, an algorithm tells us how to do something, not, the state of the world, such as E equals MC squared, which is a statement about the equality of two quantities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of course, without realizing it or knowing it or being aware of it, these algorithms are around us all the time. And, and especially, too, of course, as we work on computers. And I know some of your book talks a little bit about that that transition, too. There's been some great, historical texts written about how algorithms change from something that we do as humans and to something that we could codify and place and have our machines do for us.
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt that everyone who sort of uses a computer today is just surrounded by algorithms. They're swirling around us. All of the big websites that we use, like Google and Facebook and so on, have ingenious algorithms running behind them, which give us the sort of fantastic services that we've come to expect as normal. But actually, I mentioned this very simple example of adding two numbers as an example of an algorithm, but really more profound algorithms have existed before computers came along. So probably the oldest recorded algorithm is known as Euclid's algorithm, after the Greek mathematician Euclid, who wrote down this algorithm over 2,000 years ago. And, this is something that's used in mathematics. It's used to, I'll use some technical words here. It's used to find the greatest common divisor of two different numbers. But I just mentioned that because that's thousands of years old, yet it's an algorithm. Coming up to more modern times, the person who many people regard as the founder of computer science was a British scientist called Alan Turing. And he is famous for, during the Second World War, doing secret cryptography work that helped to crack the German naval codes. And he was coming up with algorithms for decrypting these codes. Many people believe that these algorithms saved a lot of lives and helped to end the war earlier than it otherwise would have. And again, this was in the 1940s, just at the birth of the digital computer age, and these algorithms that Alan Turing was coming up with were actually being implemented partly by mechanical devices, partly by pencil and paper. So you can see that this concept of an algorithm is it doesn't necessarily have to be linked to computers, but these days, of course, computers are the things that can execute algorithms millions of times faster than any other method we have, and that's where we really see the power of them today, and that's how it influences society.
Yeah, and that's a great example, too, is I definitely wanted to talk about Turing and about cryptography in general, because one of the algorithms that you talk about in your book, and you had to pick nine, I know, and one of them that you brought up was public key cryptography, public key cryptography,
that's
which
right. Yep.
Allows us to share information information that is confidential on the internet with at least some degree of confidence that this information is not going to be visible and available to people that we don't want it to be, such as our credit card numbers when we buy something on Amazon or eBay, or you know, any sort of confidential message and information. How did Turing doing this with mechanical components and pieces, you know, and then you get to a stage where you know, you don't have any. And this happened, of course, in World War II as well, where there was no presumption of secrecy in the message that was sent from one location to another. How is that being used today, those same kind of concepts today?
Right. Well, there's a lot of different parts to your question, so let me try and pick it apart a little there. We have to be a bit careful with our definitions. In fact, the crypto that Alan Turing was using in the Second World War was not public key cryptography. In fact, no one invented public key cryptography. It was completely unknown until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So that's a particular type of crypto that is extremely important for how the Internet works today, but it was not being used in the Second World War. Now, so let's just sort of think a little bit about what the problem on the Internet that we have is kind of a new one that they didn't necessarily have, say, you know, the military in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
They had ways of distributing secret keys to all of their commanders, and these keys are what you use to first encrypt at one end and then decrypt at the other end a message. Now, when you, say, go to Amazon and decide you want to buy a book and type in your credit card number in order to do that, that credit card number is going to be sent to a server at Amazon somewhere that your computer has never communicated with before. There has been no opportunity to, in advance, agree on a key that you're going to be using to first encrypt the credit card number and then decrypt it at the other end. So this is a sort of extra problem that faces us on the Internet every time we want to have secure communication with another entity.
Mm-hmm.
And remarkably, this idea that was invented in the 1970s was actually invented by two completely separate groups of people that didn't know each other had done it. This invention allows you to agree on a key that will be secret. Even people who can listen to every single thing that you communicate with Amazon and everything that Amazon says to you, so mm-hmm. if someone was somehow snooping on your communication, this is a remarkable and counterintuitive thing. But public key cryptography allows you to agree on a secret key that a snooper cannot obtain.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really, I mean, without this amazing piece of sort of algorithmic ingenuity that was invented in the 1970s, the Internet as we know it would simply not exist. It would be completely different. We couldn't have secure business transactions on the Internet.
Yeah, and the way that it's described in the book is great. And you use cans of paint and a variety of methods for making it actually surprisingly clear as to how this extremely complicated thing occurs. And it also, too, makes it easier to understand why some of these computer breaches now are occurring. You know, one thing that you set up is an environment where you've got three individuals who are trying to communicate, private messages to each other, and you have that, you know, supposed public area where everyone can see everything. But it also mm-hmm. Supposes that each individual has their own little private area that they can work from that the others cannot see. And
right.
and that, I think, it kind of gives us a clue as to why a lot of the direction and intrusion technologies that are advancing are not focused on capturing information that's being transmitted. They're really focused on getting behind that private screen so that they can decode these messages much easier by having that private piece, that single piece of private information that's required, whether that be your password or the keys and the hash on the other side.
Yes, that's exactly right. So, you know, what you pointed out there is an approach that I tried to take with all nine areas that are covered in the book, where You know, these algorithms are explained without assuming any knowledge of computer science or mathematics. So, you know, the target audience really is people who hopefully are interested in finding out about computers and technology, but they certainly don't need to know anything about it. And the way that I've tried to do it wherever possible is by using analogies and examples of things that we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that example of two people in a room trying to sort of exchange a secret message while someone else is also in the room, listening to everything that they say and watching everything that they do, I mean, it's a little difficult to give all the details in a radio show or a radio podcast,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, that's the sort of way that I've tried to explain many of these algorithms. And then focusing on the particular thing that you identified there, yes, I mean, as we already discussed, public key crypto is this amazing idea that lets you agree on a secret key even when someone's snooping. And by the way, just in case people think that might be unrealistic, this analogy of sort of trying two people trying to talk in a room with someone else listening to everything they say, when your computer talks to another computer on the internet, and again, let's think of you on your laptop communicating with a server at Amazon, every single packet, every single piece of information that goes between those two computers typically goes through about a dozen other computers on its way. These computers are known as routers, and they are what direct all the traffic through the internet. And, you know, most of these are run pretty carefully by companies that know what they're doing, but you never know when one of those routers might have been compromised by a malicious hacker, mm-hmm. and that hacker could see every single piece of data that goes through these computers. So that's why it's a relevant analogy to think of, okay, two people standing in a room trying to communicate secretly while someone else can hear everything that they're saying.
Yes. Yeah, I even like, I think even better, the example that started off the chapter with, you know, sending a postcard instead of something in an envelope. You've written
right.
your information on the postcard. Clearly, everyone that touches that can see and read that information and use it however they see fit. So being able to develop this methodology for communication really was a vital part of creating the Internet as we know it today.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, communication on the internet is like sending postcards. Everyone that sort of touches that postcard on its way through the system can glance at it and see everything on it. So if it's not encrypted, people are going to know what's there.
Yep. Now, another one that you brought up here, too, which I think is just as vital and that we certainly I experience every single day, is starts off the book with search engine indexing. And, you know, this is so much in our consciousness right now, but I think so very misunderstood, or you know, it's kind of like, you know, with your car, you turn your car on and it runs. I go to Google and I type words in and magically things come up. How does search engine indexing, I mean, just even some basic handle of how that happens?
Right. Well, I mean, this is such a sort of feature of our lives now, and we've really just come to expect this extraordinary level of service from search engines, like Google and Microsoft Bing search engine is another one. And it's such an important aspect that I actually devoted two chapters of the book to web search. The first one talks about indexing, and the next one is another algorithm that many people believe helped to launch Google into its premier position in the web search world. An algorithm called PageRank that was invented by the two founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. But let's go back to the first one that you asked me about, which is search engine indexing. So, I mean, here's the problem. There are literally billions of web pages out there on the World Wide Web, and when you enter a query, you want to know more or less instantaneously which of those pages actually match your query.
Yep.
Well, how do we do it? It's the very first simplest solution is the same way as you would look up a term in the index of a book. So how does the index of a book work? Well, all of the terms that you might be interested in looking up are recorded in the index, and we note which pages they occur on and list them in alphabetical order so that we can easily find them. So this is the very first basic step in constructing a web search index, but you know, Google does have an index of everything on the web, and it's stored in something that is a bit like alphabetical order, and after every term that you might search for, they have a list of all of the pages where that term occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So this is indeed, you know, an index. It's called indexing, and computer scientists study indexing as a topic in its own right.
Yep, and one of the things that you do too is you talk about and you do this with all the algorithms. I love this. Is you break them out into tricks too, and and ways that make this easier. You know, obviously, just creating lists of words that happen to be in a document isn't going to give us you know, tremendous depth of information about what it is that we've discovered. But using tricks like the meta word trick, and then later when page rankings, looking at the you know, the random surfer trick and things like
right.
this.
Yeah.
Really make a difference.
Yeah, so this was one of the really cool things, and it was really gratifying to me as I was working on the book, was I sort of was amazed to discover that all of these algorithms I chose to explain actually do boil down to relatively simple nuggets of ideas that make them work. And I've given each one what I hope is a cute label, the such and such trick. Just to try and help us sort of remember and understand what is the key idea in each algorithm. So let's just take one of the ones you mentioned there, the meta word trick. So this is to do with web search indexing, and you know I sort of simplified the problem when I described it before. I said all we want to do is from all the billions of web pages out there, find the ones that match the query that you put in. Well, that's not good enough. You might put in a query that has tens of thousands or even millions of matches. And obviously, you don't want to comb through tens of thousands of results to find the thing that you're actually interested in. So web search engines have to not only find all the matching pages, but rank them in such a way that they can present to you just the top few that you're willing to spend some time looking at. And they should present to you the most relevant ones to your query. So
that's
this
right.
is a very hard problem for them to solve, and there are many, many ways of sort of improving the ranking of web pages. But one of them is via this thing called the meta word trick. And the idea is, well, we'd like to know if on a particular page, suppose you entered the query Tech Talk. You're looking for your own podcast. You want to quickly find it.
I do this all the time.
Right. So a page that happens to have the word tech and talk somewhere in it may be relevant to your query, but a page whose title says Tech Talk has a much higher chance of being relevant, and we should rank it higher.
Mm.
So the problem is that in that index that I described before, the list of places where the word tech occurs would just be a big list of web pages on the internet, and the same with talk. So the question is, how do we know whether it was in the title or not? Well, it turns out that through this thing called the meta word trick, which is actually pretty simple, but I'm not going to go into the details of it right now, there's a pretty small change we can make to this index that will enable us to know whether a word occurred in the title, or was it labeling an image or something like that. And this can help search engines to greatly improve the ranking of that list of results that they give you.
Yep. And as you identified too, of course, and as we mentioned earlier, knowing how this works also allows you to understand a little bit how some of this web spam and search engine optimization, you know, quote unquote, can operate, and how the attempts are made to fool these algorithms. Because these algorithms, as we said earlier, you know, these are not things that humans have to be involved with. These are just rote recipe material that go through, and using them against themselves, I guess, is
yes, absolutely.
Big
so
business.
It sounds like you're well aware of the fact that there's a constant arms race between web search companies on the one hand and so-called search engine optimization companies on the other. So these search engine optimizers are people that claim to improve the ranking of your own website. If you become a customer of them, they're going to improve the ranking of your website on search engines. And you know, to do this, they reverse engineer how they believe search engines like Bing and Google work, and try to craft certain aspects of your page in a way that it's going to be ranked higher. Now, of course, Google and Microsoft do not want pages to have an artificially inflated rank. And so they have teams of scientists constantly working on this problem, which is actually known as the web spam problem.
Yep.
An analogy to email spam. This is sort of unwanted web pages that rise up the rankings because someone has done something artificial. And, those teams of scientists are constantly working on new ways of combating web spam. It's discussed at conferences all the time. Academic computer scientists publish on this topic. And it's a mini industry in its own right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, John, I apologize. I'm going to have to pull us to a quick closer. I believe that people have at least gotten a taste for some of the information that's available. But, man, there are so many places we could go from here with databases and data compression, pattern recognition, digital signatures, error. I mean, it goes on and on. It's a fantastic book. Where can people find more information about 9 algorithms that change the future and the book and yourself?
Well, thanks to search engines, it's actually pretty easy. If you type 9 algorithms into your favorite search engine, you're going to find some links pretty quickly. There's a Facebook page, facebook.com/9algorithms, for instance. I maintain my own page about it, but any search engine will get you there very quickly, so that's probably the easiest way.
Fantastic. So thanks to one of those algorithms, you'll have no problem finding the other 8.
Right, exactly.
Well, John, it has been an honor. Thank you so much. What a great conversation, we wish you all the luck.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure being on the show.
Take care. Have a great weekend.
Bye now.
Bye.
Good job.
John McCormick with 9 algorithms that change
Exciting
the future.
Stuff, yeah,
it really, really is. And I can't talk highly enough about it. I don't want to sound like a shill, but it is a great book. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. It was one of those perks of being a radio
available
guy.
Available through Princeton Press.
Available through Princeton Press, Amazon. There's a number of places to get it. It is really very, very good. We're out of time. I am not going to do any Cool Sites of the Week. I'll put up links to the book, links to John's page. I'll give you a link to that Hipmunk as well that I mentioned earlier. And I'm going to leave you with a podcast-only song of the week. It's by Frightened Rabbit is the name of the band, and off of their album, The Winter of Mixed Drinks. And which is good just for that. The title is Swim Until You Can't See Land. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this week. I hope you'll stick around and come back next week. And don't forget to check us out on facebook.com/techtalkWRLR.
Thanks for listening to WRLR Round Lake Heights.
Have a great weekend.
And a knock to the board and that drove me here to face the tide and swim. I swam. Oh, swam. Dip a toe in the ocean. Oh, how it hardens and it numbs. The rest of me is a version of man built to collapse and crumb. And if I hadn't come now to the coast to disappear, I may have died in a landslide of rocks and hopes and fear. So I swim until you can't see land. Swim until you can't see land. Swim until you can't see land. Are you a man and you a fire? marker line.